The following programming is sponsored by Dr. Joseph Fallon Jr. The views expressed do not necessarily reflect the views of this station, its management, or Beasley Media Group.
It's time once again to get inside the world of medicine as prominent endocrinologist Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. brings you Inside Medicine. Stay tuned for interviews with eminent medical specialists and receive vital information about your health. Now, here is Dr. Joseph J. Fallon Jr. with another edition of Inside Medicine.
Thank you, Barry, as usual. We have a fantastic program set up. We have Raphael Hasbens, who's been in practice many years as an internist. Additionally, he has been for the last 4 years in the Cooper Health System, prior to that into the Jefferson Hospital System, and prior to that, delivering excellent care for many patients through an office-type practice. Dr. Hasbens is mentally quick. He can make decisions quickly, which you need in a physician, and has a wonderful family. Raphael, welcome to Inside Medicine.
Thank you very much, Joe. It's a pleasure to be here with you guys.
Oh, all right. So let me ask you this. You take care of many problems for many years. One thing I want to ask about is one that I don't like to take care of, and that's low back pain. How does that work out with you and your patients and the physician-patient relationship?
It's very important because it's very frequent that we see this almost every day with patients with back pain. And even if they don't manifest it, they do have it. And we're going to talk about it so the people will become aware when to look for medical help and their back pain. If I can just start telling you the 84, now listen to this carefully, 84%. of the adult, not only United States, but the whole world, will have back pain sometime in their life. Now, out of these 84%, the majority will be self-limit and usually lasts for 4 weeks. So we can divide the back pain in acute, subacute, and chronic. So if the pain is between 1 to 4 weeks, we consider that acute. Can happen in younger and in older patients. To be subacute is before 4 weeks and 12 weeks of duration. More than 12 weeks is those ones that we have to deal with. Those are chronic and usually have some kind of etiology. Now, the acute and subacute back pain usually we can't find the theology of the reason why these people have back pain. And we use the terminologies of any specific back pain because we will never find them. So most of the back pain will resolve within 4 weeks with or without just oral treatment. We don't have to be very aggressive with them. Now, normally, many of those people, if they have never had a back pain and the pain is severe, they will want to have an x-ray. They want to have some MRI, and it doesn't work that way, especially in insurance. Today, they're very strict with the requisition of when to obtain those images. And that's costly, and we understand that. Now, on the acute pain, which are mostly non-specific back pain, in younger or in adults, We just start the treatment with a non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, and we cancel or discuss the situation with the patients. Normally, it will just go in the 4 weeks, or it start getting better real quick. In those patients, we don't need to get not even an x-ray. If they're going to be resolving in 4 weeks, even if it's old patients, which we are more careful, and I will say in the future why we have to be careful more with the age, and the implication of that. And the younger people, I will never do an x-ray because there's no need. Most of the time, it's either muscular, it's either the tendon, they were doing some kind of exercise, especially if you get a good history. The history is so important in the back pain. And they were in the gym the day before. They were picking up something heavy, and they're just scared that they may have herniated this. And they hear so many things in the media and Dr. Google, and they go through that. I mean, and we have to just clarify them and listen. This is not the way that goes, and you don't have to worry. And you just try to pacify them and to calm them down. Most of them will agree with that.
We start the treatment.
Yes.
So, Rafael, you talked about you using NSAID. Could you just give an example of one you use? Because different NSAIDs are stronger and some are not. So do you have a favorite NSAID that if someone's listening in, they may want to ask their physician if they get that back pain for?
Well, the those acute and specific back pain, especially in younger people, that they don't have any contraindication for NSAID, which are naproxen, is one of the favorite ones that we use, diclofenac, with just be careful with the liver. If the patient may have some other medication that interfere with the liver, we prefer to use either naproxen or ibuprofen, 800. And that will be the first line. Now, can you mix ibuprofen with acetaminophen or Tylenol? Absolutely, yes. And in fact, it is recommended even Tylenol or acetaminophen by itself. Now, when do we use muscle relaxant? In those patients that complain that they cannot sleep because of the pain, especially in the acute time of the pain, we give you some of the muscle relaxant that at the same time will make you to relax and sleep well. It is necessary for them to sleep so the muscle will relax it. And we use the Flexeril, the Tizanidine too, as well. They work very well in those patients. We used to use Soma, but because of the addiction to this type of muscle relaxant, we don't prescribe it much anymore. But the Flexeril naturally and the naproxen plus or the ibuprofen instead of the naproxen is what we prescribe first. Now, let me tell you, the non-steroidal anti-inflammatory has different effects in different persons. Some people will tell you that the naproxen works better than the ibuprofen, than the Dapro, than the Relafen. And some other will say, no, for me, the naproxen doesn't work. It's like, it's beyond the treatment that we do. And we know that some of the anti-inflammatory will be more effective in other kind of persons. So we can try with either one. We can start with the ibuprofen if they have it available. And if it doesn't work, we can switch to other non-steroidal anti-inflammatory, and we can add the Tylenol to it. And if they cannot sleep well, like I said before, a muscle relaxant, especially most of them give you, make you sleepy and drowsy, that will give them a good night's sleep.
Now, so Rafael, what's the usual dose? Rafael, what's the usual dose for a patient that gives you a call in the middle of the night? And, you know, I got to go to the ER and get an x-ray. Well, what's the usual dose of, say, a non-steroidal that you would use so that you can calm them down and avoid them waiting in the emergency room?
Absolutely. I mean, anybody has no contraindication if it's a younger man or an older. In the younger man, we use 800 of the ibuprofen three times a day. They can use it every 8 hours safely. If they can add 1 gram of Tylenol three times a day, which is also safe. They can take it together. And, you know, this they can be available over the counter. The Tylenol is available over the counter. If they can take the Advil, get 800 milligrams of that, they can just obtain that over the counter and do it three times a day. That will help a lot of them. Now, all the naproxen, we use the 500 twice a day or the 550. And they both work pretty much similar. And they can also add the Tylenol to it, and that will give an extra analgesic effect in their lower back pain. So that's important. And this is before we start getting prescription. Naproxen is a leaf, which is only a 250, but they take two of the 250, you make it 500, so they can take two in the morning, two at night. Preferably with food because we don't want to create any irritation on the gastric area.
Now, okay, so what you're saying is the patients can help themselves.
Exactly.
They can help themselves, but they have to make sure that they get the right dose.
The right dose is very important. Somebody who is, say, 180 pounds, take 200 or 400 ibuprofen, really it's not going to do much for them. Now, there was a study that was a long time ago that they compared the 400, 600, and 800 milligram of ibuprofen for the back pain, and they considered that it was pretty similar. But I don't see that in the practice. I have three patients with 600 and with 800, and it make a difference. It does make a difference. So before they, you know, get into a prescription, and especially like you say, it's during the night, they don't have the time to wait for the pharmacy is closed, and they can go to Walmart that is open. They can buy that over the counter and self-medicate safely with this medication until the next day they talk to the physician or their primary and try to get a prescription stronger or some muscle relaxant, which all of them are prescribed medicine, all the muscle relaxant. So at that point...
So Rafael, can you just go back on this? So what's the difference between acute, subacute, and chronic, just for a summary?
Yes. Like I was saying, that most of the acute pain, which is what we're going to see in the office of primary care, those are in a specific back pain. And it usually lasts from 1 to 4 weeks. So we can, you know, just get the patient comfortable and reassure them that, listen, normally those back pain last up to 4 weeks, maybe a little more, but it's going to start getting better. Those are the acute ones. Subacute is like it's been already a month and a half, so it's 6 weeks. I still having those pain, and in those cases are subacute. We don't take much action on those. Except prescribe more medicine, painkillers, in addition to the non-steroidal, just to get their pain under control. And in those chronic pain that could be severe too, are those who are really, we have to pay more attention. Those are the ones that are more than 12 weeks of pain. And especially if this pain is associated with any kind of other symptoms. It could be neurological. It could be abdominal pain. It could be they have the cold sciatic pain. And those ones, we have to be just look it up with more intention, with more precaution. Because it could be something, especially in the people with age, you know, more than 60 years old, where cancer and other circumstances, abdominal, visceral, prostatitis, chronic pelvic pain, nephrolithiasis, pyelonephritis, or kidney stone can be the cause of the back pain, even the pancreatitis, because the pain is referred to the back. Now, the non-mechanical pain, it could be either metastatic cancer any of the cancer. The most common naturally are the breast cancer, the prostate cancer, and the lung cancer. They usually have preference for the bones as a metastasis. In those people, we have to be very careful. Now, in osteoporotic patients, so they're just a certain age, same thing can happen. They can have the situation with a cancer metastasized to the spine, or they can have a compression fracture, for example, because, you know, at a certain age, even men, we fail to get more DEXA scan in men, absolutely, because we also can get osteoporosis. And the female, when they come out and, you know, certain age, 70 years old with a back pain, and they've been having the back pain for a while, then we must get at least start getting an x-ray, because many of them will have a compression fracture. Now, the 4% of the compression fractures are people don't even realize they have. It is asymptomatic, and they don't feel it. But eventually, when they, you know, have another compression fracture, it may cause the pain. That's when we discover that they have more than one compression fracture. And then, you know, we start with a treatment for them. Then we also have patients...
Rafael, can I ask you a question? Can you just explain a DEXA scan to the listening patients, because DEXA scanning is very important, and a lot of people don't understand what that gives you as a physician.
Absolutely. As we get older, especially if we are not very active doing exercises, and or if we are taking, because you have asthma, glucocorticoid, or you have a hereditary pattern with your mother had it also, and you are, or you smoker, develop a weakness in the bone structure. Instead of the bone being very strong when you fall or when you move, they are a little weaker so they can break easier. Many of these, especially in elderly patients, when they have a fall, they have a fracture of the hip, the femur, it is because they are osteoporotic, which means they are empty, they are hollow. They don't have the structure called trabeculas. They are the one to hold the bone together. In those situations, it can be a lot of complications. You know, you can have the fracture of the hip, then you can develop an emboli, you can go to the lung, even cause death in certain people. So it is important to obtain this simple test called DEXA scan. Men and female, both actually should get it, because we also get osteoporosis like females do. And like I said before, especially if you all have some other conditions like asthma, COPD, and they're giving you steroids, that is one of the main causes of osteoporosis. Now, it's very easy to get the DEXA scan. You can ask your primary to order for you. And if very osteoporotic, you can have a consultation with the endocrinology or rheumatology, and they can start your medication, or we can start you. If it's very advanced, we prefer you to see the endocrinologist or rheumatologist so they can use intravenous or injectable. They are more effective for the pain of the grade of the osteoporosis. Normally, in the DEXA scan, anything that is minus 2.5, we consider osteoporosis. But I have patients that have minus 5. And those patients, they really need a very serious and aggressive treatment. Because besides that, they can have a compression fracture of the vertebra in the back. They can have any fracture any place. And we call them pathological fractures too, because it's osteoporosis. Not just the cancer can cause the fracture, but also the osteoporosis. So it's very important to have this test. Especially female, they are pre- or postmenopausal. And men, about 60, they should get it as just routine, or a baseline to see how they are doing.
So, Raphael, and can I just say something about that DEXA scan? Because people have to realize that Medicare does a great job for people with bad backs that have had compression fractures, and that the DEXA scan is given every 2 years. So what Medicare does is they pay $1,500 a shot, and they're going to okay you because you have osteoporosis for 4 shots. And then, again, you can then repeat your studies. But that the Prolia is a phenomenal product. I've had one insurance company say, "Dr. Fallon, order it for our patients, and we'll have a nurse come out and give it." The only problem with that is, which really makes me mad, is that they want to have the patient or a nurse come out and give a $1,500 shot. Who's going to be responsible if the shot's no good? So generally, anybody who asks me to give a DEXA scan, basically, I give the shots, and at the end of 2 years, we can redo a DEXA so to see how well their progress is. So DEXA scanning is one of the best things ever. When I was in the hospital, all the auto accident people were always shocked that they don't break any more bones when they start the Prolia every 6 months. Great product, and Medicare does great to the patients for that issue. Carry on, Raphael.
Yeah, definitely, you know, that's one of my favorite too. The Prolia, I think, is great. The Fortea is excellent. The only thing is people they're not too happy to have a shot every day for 2 years. And that's one of the cons. But the Prolia is every 6 months, so it's a wonderful product. Yes. And then in those patients,
I agree with you 100%.
Yes. And those patients that they have a severe pain, and it's been more than 12 weeks, carefully we try to implement some of the opioids in them. And we use it most of the time, Vicodin, hydrocodone, knowing that they can get an addiction, and we have a big problem with the addiction in the United States and over the world. So we are very careful to use and try to limit it because the people can get addicted to them. But if they're in severe pain, we should start it very carefully. Now, what else can we use? If the patient has any radiculopathy, which you mean is in neurological involvement because there's a herniated disc, let's just say an example. In those patients, other medications work as well. We have the gabapentin that works for the pain, and many, many neurologists use it for that too. I, on myself, prefer the pregabalin, which is Lyrica. That's my favorite one on the neuroleptic medication to use for the sciatic pain or the neurological pain. And also they can use medication like Cymbalta, which is also held, is an antidepressant, but it does work for pain as well. And by the way, just since we talk about Cymbalta, some of the back pain's origins are psychosomatic. So in those people that have this type of pain, duloxetine, which is Cymbalta, work great on those patients. Now, we're just going to refer to some of the back pain and the etiologies in there, especially which one are more with had to do more with the back pain, with the back, and the others that are no related to the back, but they can give you a back pain. Especially when I remember I worked in the emergency room as moonlighting. And I remember one patient that came, he was about 70 or 65, 70, and he was having back pain. His primary physician was treating him with naproxen and Flexeril. And I remember examining him and feel this pulsating mass in the abdomen. So he was having a dissecting abdominal aneurysm. And he did not complain of abdominal pain. He was complaining of back pain. So in those patients, it's extremely important to palpate the abdomen. You know, somebody who is more than 70 years old and coming with a back pain, you must examine the abdomen. I mean, besides pancreatitis and besides nephrolithiasis or cholecystitis, this is a life-saving exam. So I felt the mass. It was pulsating. It was like at 3 o'clock in the morning. And we did call the vascular surgeon. He came in like in 15, 20 minutes. They have everything ready in the OR. Thank God he performed the surgery and the man was safe. So that is very important that we understand that other abdominal circumstances can cause you also back pain. We talk about an ulcer. You know, it's very common, gastritis. People complaining of epigastric pain, but they also complain of back pain. Those ones, you have to be careful when you take the history so you can differentiate that. Now, another one which you have to do more with those patients that are age-related, for example, 65 and above, are the cancer. We do have a very well-known multiple myeloma, which it really is like eat the bone. And the pain is constant. And those people, the pain start slowly in the cancer people. but it doesn't decrease. It keeps increasing in pain, increasing in strength in those pain. So those people, you have to be careful and evaluate for other causing the back pain. We also have all this cancer that we mentioned that can metastasize to the spine. We also have the leukemia, which is a liquid cancer, and the lymphoma that can also affect your spine. We have tumor also that are proper of the spine, and infections. People that come with fever, people we come with chills, and they say this pain starts very slow, but it's getting more. All we think in osteomyelitis, which means an infection. Those are emergency and they need to be seen by your primary physician immediately. Those that have dyschitis, a cervical septic dyschitis, And also we have the anti-inflammatory one, which the ankylosing spondylitis, and I know you did have a rheumatologist giving a talk about it a few weeks ago. I could see that in your podcast. So he probably was touching about the ankylosing spondylitis, which is those inflammatory, it's inflammatory disease that will fuse your vertebra and you will remain in one position. This is chronic pain. I have younger patients with this situation. I mean, I'm talking like 30 years old, younger guys that have the beginning of this disease. And then it's not an easy and a beautiful one. It's very ugly because they restrict the movement and they will eventually be fusing all the vertebrae. They're going to just keep that position forever. Now, with a biological agent, we have some improvement in this disease, but it's not as much that we completely stop it. Then we have the psoriatic spondylitis, reactive arthritis, and people that have Crohn's disease, ulcerative colitis. That's also very common to develop arthritis in the spine as well as the joints. Paget's disease.
Raphael, can I just ask you a question? Because basically, you know, some of these conditions are going to be noted for severe pain. And the patients are always want an MRI. How do you handle that question? Because you don't want to miss anything. But the patient says, listen, doctor, I need an MRI. Is there any criteria that you use to answer the patient for, I need an MRI? You know, and some people just have a small cut, but a lot of times they have the correct interpretation. How do you deal with that? That's a tough call in my mind.
We hear that all the time. Now, the insurance company, like we were saying before, have those rules. And we sometimes take those rules to explain the patient. If a patient comes with just localized pain and there's no neurological compromise, we try to explain and listen. We get an MRI if you're going to get something else done, like you have a herniated disc that is causing you a radiculopathy and you're getting weak in your legs. I understand that would be an emergency to do the MRI just to make sure that you don't have any kind of compression on the nerve and it can kill the nerve. Now, in those patients that they have no neurological deficit and they just have localized pain, we try to tell them, listen, first thing we're going to do, if you don't get better in 4 weeks, we get an X-ray. You need to go to physical therapy because even if you have a herniated disc, the insurance is not going to approve the MRI if we don't have the physical therapy. And then after 4 weeks of physical therapy, 4 weeks waiting, then that is when it's get approved, especially the patient have neurological symptoms like the sciatic pain that they relieve, which is a burning pain going to your lower extremity. It could be right, left, or both. Now, in those people that they present already with neurological deficit and they have bladder incontinence and they have, for example, bowel incontinence or the Cota-Equina syndrome, then in those patients, we don't wait time. We go right to it. If we need to call the insurance, say we need to get this approved and we need to get it now. But these are the minimal. This is like less than 1% of the patient will present with this. Most of the patient is back pain, and then later on, they may or not develop the sciatic nerve or neurological. So we do have time to that. We explain it. It's not that I don't want to do it. It's that this is the right thing to do, especially if students not going to pay for this. And they understand, and they go for the therapy. Now, many people, when they go to the physical therapy, will say, hey, doc, you know, my back pain is getting worse going to physical therapy. And now my legs is getting numb. I don't feel much. It's getting numb off and on. Well, in those patients, you just stop it and say, listen, don't go to therapy. And let's, you know, talk to the students, try to get your MRI done after an X-ray, naturally. Especially if it's a herniated disc, which is the most common cause of all the Cota-Equina. And I'm talking about herniated disc. The most common radiculopathy caused by the herniation of the disc is L5-S1. So you can say 90% of the radiculopathies are L5-S1. In those patients, and they start having pain coming all the way from the back, gluteal area, knee, sometimes they complain of knee pain, but it's caused by the same sciatic nerve, and they get to the legs, to the feet. In those patients, we try to get the MRI sooner than later, because especially they're 65 and above, those patients could be any cancer and metastasize, compressing the cord. We don't want to pitch that late, because the longer we wait, the more compromised we are with this. And in those patients...
Okay, so go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, in those patients, after we diagnose with a radiculopathy, normally we send it for an ENG just to make sure what is after the MRI, how bad is the compression of the nerve and how much is affecting it, or an examination that will, you know, present weakness, especially elevating the legs. And you can press and look for neurological signs yourself as a primary physician too, or yourself, the patient, and notice that your legs are getting weaker, then the pain is getting worse. Well, those patients may end having surgery, especially the compression of the root of the nerve is severe, because we can say we can delay that surgery, because in those patients are justified to do it, to release the nerve from the encroachment from the either the herniated disc, or if you have severe arthritis, for the arthritis as well. That this is going to be more common in elderly 70 and above patients.
So Raphael, do you want to move on to pneumonia, or do we want to cover any additional areas here, such as any drugs that you would recommend for somebody who's a postmenopausal woman, especially if there's a family history of losing height?
Yes, and then we're going to go to the injections too, to the epidural. And now we do have certain patients, and I just want to cover this before we go to the menopausal woman. And those patients, they don't want to have surgery, but they do have some radiculopathy. We know that they have a herniated disc. It is very justifiable to have an epidural. That will take the inflammation of the nerve, and it may by itself release from the encroachment at the disc itself, it will suck itself. So many of the discs, and this is something that people don't understand, that disc can't regret by itself. Yes, it can't regret going to remission by itself. When you are well hydrated and you rest enough, and the disc can reverse, and then the compression on the nerve will be released. So that's excellent. So when we get the epidural, what we inject is normally methylprednisolone, which is called depomedrol, and together with the anesthetic, just to make it softer there, that is a very potent anti-inflammatory, especially if the pain specialist or the anesthesiology pain specialist, since they deal with the spine, if they get the right place where the herniated disc is, and they do it, now they do it with ultrasound, which would be a great assessment, and just to approach the right location, that nerve, it will get relieved from the encroachment, because all this anti-inflammatory will be localized in the area, and the pain will definitely get better and back to normal in there. So that's one. Now, how many epidural can you have? Well, you can have every 3 months up to 3 or 4. If they found that after 4 epidural, you are not getting better, so there's no reason why to continue giving you epidural. Or, by the way, they're also using, in people who are elderly, radioablation, especially if the compression of the root of the nerve is caused by osteoarthritis. And with the radio frequency ablation, they give you relief for a certain time. They usually can last up to more than 6 to 8 months relief of the pain. Now, the problem is that this is not permanent and it may come back. So we haven't perfected any technique that will completely relieve the nerve. Now, the other situation which most of the time will require surgery is when you have spinal stenosis. as we get older, our spinal canal, which is where the spinal cord go through, it will get narrow. As that get narrow, it will be compressed. And if this is compressed, you're not going to be able to walk well. You're going to be in a wheelchair. You get weaker in your lower extremity. And in those situations, the only treatment, it will be surgery, because epidural will not work. Now, it is very successful in the surgery. Nowadays, with all the medical advance, it's not that risky, especially if, quote-unquote, we're healthy at that age and you don't have any kind of heart problems. You should have the surgery. The surgery is so effective that I have had patients that had the surgery and the same day they have walked well without problem. So it's a very important to think about it, because there's other people that refuse surgery. And those people will end in a wheelchair, because eventually the compression of the cord is so much that they're going to lose the control. So I would recommend to get a new neurosurgeon, get a good location where the neurosurgeon do a lot of these procedures. And it's a very safe procedure to do. But we don't have any other treatment for that. And unfortunately, as we get older, this is going to happen in many of us. So spinal stenosis, going to knee surgery. Another of the back pain that we have very frequently is when the patient comes having sciatic pain, so pain that goes from the gluteal area and it follows all the way down to the heel or to the foot. And they don't complain of back pain. They just have the pain that goes from the gluteal area all the way down. Those patients have what we call a piriformis syndrome. Piriformis is a muscle that is, it goes from the sacral to the superior spine of the femur there, and it compresses the spine when it's contracted. So those people can improve themselves with exercise, they can find that in YouTube, piriformis exercise. And if they don't, we apply an injection directly to close to the tendon with the piriformis, and it's a very easy shot with the depomedrol and a little bit of lidocaine or marcaine, and they get better from this. But it just looked like sciatic, and it is sciatic pain, but it's no compression of the nerves in the spine. The compression is in your gluteal area. So if your pain goes from the gluteal down, your spine is okay. This is compression of this muscle. And the approach is simple. Even with the exercise, like I said, you can get better. Now, I think we conclude with this. At least, if you have any other question for back pain,
Joe? Well, Raphael, I would say fantastic presentation. And but I do know that you handle a lot of infections in the outpatient setting. So what, and I'm going to ask you, what antibiotics do you use and for what?
Exactly. Yeah. Listen, we're going to talk about a very, very common situation, because upper respiratory is all the time one of the main or leading cause of morbidity and mortality. It's not that leading cause, but it's one of the leading cause of morbidity and mortality and worldwide. And this lower respiratory infection, which we call community-acquired pneumonia, it is very important for us to see, to treat, especially in elderly or in compromised people. Now, the people that come to us, and this is very common. You know, you hear that all the time. They call you on the phone. Hey, doc, you know, I have a cold. Can you give me some antibiotic? Well, you just have to find a little bit more just to start any antibiotic, because we don't want to create any resistance in any patient or in the community to antibiotic, especially the most common ones. So what we have to look at in the patient who's calling is, number one, is their age. Number two, either have any chronic comorbidity, and we're talking about those people that have asthma, COPD, and this is most of the time it's, you know, the upper respiratory infection start with a virus. Now, it can become lower respiratory infection when they go to your lungs. And it is important if you do have cancer and you are immunocompromised, and say even people with diabetes, they become immunocompromised due to the immunity. It doesn't work like a young person. And also those people who are 70 above, 65 and above, and they have this cough and cold that they say has been more than a week. You have to be looking that serious. Now, if you see them in the office and you can examine, you realize how they look and how they're feeling, and you can ask, the main thing is, do they have fever? How long they've been sick? If anybody else is sick, especially nowadays, we do have many viruses, especially like the COVID, that's affecting a lot of people. And it's a virus, and it can create it can go to your lungs, especially in the beginning of the COVID, which we had the Alpha one. We had the Delta COVID, which were very stronger, a lot more than the Omicron. And we do have a lot of strain on the Omicron. Now, Omicron is the one that is affecting the most. And those people with active respiratory very rarely will involve their lungs. It will be mostly their sinus. They complain headache. They complain body ache. Malaise, and I usually ask them, have you tested yourself already for a COVID? If they have, we try not to bring it to the office because we don't want to spread that. And if they're positive, we are using the Paxlovid and another one antiviral, which it worked very well. 2-3 days, they're back almost to normal. Now, after the treatment, it may be some cases, especially those immunocompromised, that they have asthma, COPD, that they have improved 50%, for example. Those patients, feel better, but not totally better, but they're still coughing, producing a lot of sputum, greenies, pleuritic pain. Those people need to get an X-ray. We need to find out what else is wrong with them. Especially if you listen before, it was clear. And if it's in the office, which shouldn't, but it sounds like it has some rail, we call like a sound in the lungs, sound rails, fine rails. Those need to get an X-ray to see the extent, if it's a pneumonia, what is the extent, if it's a viral pneumonia or bacteria. Most of the time, we don't test those to see what kind of pneumonia they have. Especially if it's in the outpatient setting. If it's in the inpatient, we try to get the chlamydia, the antigen, to see what kind of other bacteria can be involved in this bronchitis or pneumonia. But in the outpatient, we don't. Now, in old age, in people that had the CPAP, the most frequent bacteria that cause this is the Streptococcus pneumoniae. And for this, the streptococcal pneumonia is the most common, 62%. And the people who are that age or have COPD or asthma, or people who use the CPAP. And those, we shouldn't delay the treatment. We should start the treatment at the same time that we get the X-ray. Now, if the X-ray is normal, but when you examine the patient did have rail or a lot of mucosity, you shouldn't stop the antibiotic. You should continue for at least 10 days. Now, if the X-ray showed that the patient have a big pneumonia or bilateral pneumonia, the patient need to be treated in the hospital. You have to send it to the emergency room because they need intravenous antibiotic, and especially the age, the people that are weak, and immunosuppressed, you oral antibiotic to start, it's going to take a long time, especially when we don't know the pathogen causing the problem. Now, those people, in the antibiotic, they will receive at least the intravenous antibiotics until their fever is off, and after 3 or 4 days, they will be discharged an oral antibiotic, and you can follow in the office again. Now, if the X-ray just shows small pneumonia, if the patient feels strong and is not so immune compromised, then the outpatient treatment will be enough. You have to choose a good antibiotic naturally, especially if you have evidence that it's a pneumonia. To see that in the X-ray, you need to have more than 10 millimeters or infiltrate. Because if it's less than that, the patient could have the pneumonia, but you don't see it on the X-ray, but you still can hear some of them. Now, we divide the community-acquired pneumonia in two types. We call the typical bacteria and the atypical pneumonia, which is a typical bacteria. The typical one are, number one, the streptococcus pneumoniae. Then we have the bovine influenza, the Mozzarella carrari, the Staphylococcus, and other. And the atypical one are the Legionella, Mycoplasma, Chlamydia. Those one respond to different antibiotics. So if you have an infiltrate, you have to at least to choose an antibiotic that covers both, especially if the patient is a COPD or a smoker. The one of the favor, especially most of the book, like to prescribe recommend for this type of pneumonia is the Levaquin, which is quinolone. Quinolone is a very good and strong antibiotic, and it's reached level similar to the intravenous administration. So it's a very good, it's reach good levels to kill the pneumonia, and I personally prefer the Avalox to me. I think it's more effective, especially with the streptococcal pneumoniae, than the Levaquin. But some of the doctors, pulmonologists, they like the level processing, Levaquin. So that's also okay with us. Now, and somebody who had like asthma and they've been coughing for a while and now they're producing sputum, but they don't have pneumonia, I will treat it with a Z-Pak, the Citromax. Because, and also the addition of esteroid in those people are definitely a plus. Even in those people that are COPD or smoker or alcoholic, that they develop pneumonia, the esteroid, or we're talking about the corticosteroid, like prednisone, it is shown to have an advantage reducing the inflammation, reducing the progression to ARDS, which is a very fatal one. And in those people, we add the prednisone, especially like I was saying, people that are, you know, immunologically compromised or their lungs are compromised, COPD. We shouldn't wait or hold the antibiotic for too long. It's been a week, the patients start having a little bit of fever, they feel warm, they start having chills. And they start with the upper respiratory like a week and a half or 10 days ago. I do find that those people will get better with the treatment and the implementation of the antibiotic. Something mild like Citromax, either they have no allergies or, and another people, also the Admentin, especially on those asthmatic COPD, the beta-lactam antibiotic work better than the Citromax, the clarithromycin 2, the biaxin, the Admentin will work better in those people. But in somebody who's healthy, a young fellow, for example, that comes to the office, and they've been coughing for a while, and they've been also having this upper respiratory that they started, now they say it's in the chest, and they feel it, but they don't have asthma, or they don't have and any other comorbidity, those people will do well just in one CPAC. You don't need more than that. You can't, and it is no wheezing or nothing else. Don't prescribe the prednisone. Just give it the Citromax and the syrup that they make it comfortable for the cough, or the Tesalon pearls that will help them with the cough as well.